Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 27th. I'm Ray Graff on this edition of Vox Pop. We do a gardening show, and we welcome two guests, arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Suzanne Ballet-Haight of Ballet Flowers and Design. They're here to answer your questions. Gardening show, always a popular one, especially as spring begins to loom. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us if you want. It's voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to as many emails as we can. This is a popular show, so call early, 800-348-2551. Fred, Suzanne, your gardening calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Well, after a couple of impeachment hearings bumped us, after a State of the State bumped us, we're finally ready to do a gardening show today. And joining us on this gardening edition of Vox Pop, Fred Breglia and Suzanne Ballet-Haight. Fred is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Suzanne comes to us by way of Ballet Flowers and Design in Malta, New York. The business offers annuals, perennials, as well as vegetables and herbs. If you have a gardening question, let's go. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Email us if you want to. voxpop@wamc.org. The number is, if you'd like to call, 800-348-2551. Fred and Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back, right?
It seems like a long time, right?
You know, too long, for sure.
We had a few bumps, and now we lost Greg Ward and Bob Graves. They're gone for good.
We're gonna make up some ground here today.
Well, we welcome Suzanne Ballet-Haight to the show. How do you feel about being here?
I'm super excited. This is going to be fun.
Tell us about Ballet Flowers and Design.
We have a lot of annuals, perennials, hanging baskets at our farm, but we're mostly a flower farm.
Yeah.
And I would say most of the season, like the summer season, we have cut your own flowers at our farm, so it kind of gives a different experience.
Cool.
But we're growing a lot of shrubs and perennials that we use on gardenscapes and help homeowners with their questions and problems at our farm as well.
Now, your concern, the Ballet Flowers and Design, this is a family thing. You're the second generation, right?
I'm the second generation, sort of.
Yeah.
We started in 1978 going to the Saratoga Farmers Market with vegetables mostly.
Right.
And then we transitioned into flowers a little bit when I was in high school, and I went to college for horticulture, and that's when I started it up into my own business in 95.
At what age did you know, hey, I want to go to school for horticulture?
I was in 4-H, so horticulture contests and vegetable crops contests, I would say I knew when I was 12. And not many people know what they want to do when they're 12.
I suspect Fred has been hugging trees since he was about 12.
Five. My mother took me up to this hill behind our house in Richmondville Summit Line. And it was she talked about this mythical giant oak tree that was growing up there, and I was too young to hike and see it. At age 5, I was big enough to make the climb and see the tree. And when I saw that tree and she explained to me the fact that so many forests have been cleared and these are just remnant trees, it impacted my life and literally sent me on a road to horticulture, big trees. And, you know, I've been looking for big trees ever since and just in love with arboriculture and horticulture. So I blame my mom for this one if she's listening today. In a good way.
Isn't the Hudson Valley home to one of the most ancient forests in the entire world?
I wouldn't say that. We have fossilized records that are amongst the oldest trees on the world that were found in New York State at a couple of different sites. We have in Saratoga County, we have the oldest black gum trees that are by far in New York State. Over in Schoharie County, we have some of the oldest red cedars that you're gonna see probably.
How old? Most.
We're talking 500-year-old.
Yeah.
And trees that are stunted that were diameters of about 5 inches or 6 inches in diameter, but pushing ages of upwards of 500 years.
That's amazing.
So sometimes a lot of people think, you know, the biggest tree has got to be the oldest tree. And of course, some of those big trees are quite old, but a lot of times the older stunted trees are often some of the smaller trees. They're growing in real harsh environments, and they sort of gear themselves to longevity. We don't have a lot of resources. We have to be misers, and they actually gear themselves for a long life. You give a tree everything it needs down in the valley floor, it says, hey, I got everything I need. I don't need to worry about saving nothing for anything.
Yeah.
And there it gets real big, but it ends up often living a shorter life.
Very interesting. Fred Breglia is here. Suzanne Ballet-Haight here. And we have a gardening show in progress. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's begin with Carrie in Plainfield. Carrie, how you doing?
Hi, Ray. Yeah, hello, Ray, and hello, your guest.
Hello.
Hello.
Recently, many of the garden centers, they've been selling bags of a special soil, and it's advertised to promote better growth of marijuana plants. And my question is that just a BS marketing tool, or does it really help, and if so, why?
You know, a lot of times with soil amending, it's not so much the label that's gonna do it. So it could be a really good thing. I don't know that particular product, but the main thing is what's contained in that soil. Because if it's going to be good for, you know, generally marijuana or any other plant, it's probably going to be good for a whole bunch of other plants too. So really, what we're talking about is just amending the soil for better plant growth. And some plants, by amending them, you're actually going to mess things up. You amend a shrub or a tree too much, you can actually create a condition for the future in not a good way. But generally with herbaceous plants, compost, and more compost. But not all composts are created equal. And you could probably elaborate on, you know, some different...
We like to try to find organic compost wherever we can, and compost that has less weed seeds in it. There's a place in Greenwich, New York, that has it's called Booth's Blend, and we just love that soil. It's pretty weed free, and it's really high in nutrients and organic matter. So,
what's the name of that soil again, please?
That's called Booth's Blend.
Booth.
Booth.
Yeah.
Booth Blend. Okay.
Yep. BOOTH, and it's a cow manure based compost, so it's got lots of nutrients, and we sometimes use a compost tea to water our plants with that, and works great.
Yep. And I will say one other thing is that sometimes compost, if they're not good, just because they're labeled a certain way, again, it really comes down to finding good quality compost, but you don't want something that's going to change your pH. And I've seen compost that are testing really, really low pH, which would make things really acidic, and some really alkaline. So you really want something that's going to be more neutral. Most plants are going to like it in that 6.8 to 7.0 pH range.
So, all right.
And if you're planting it in the ground, you may want to test your soil and get the pH of your soil to make sure that compost is going to work for you.
Yep, soil tests always recommended. Good point.
Carrie, sure. Thank you very much for the call. It's the Gardening Show on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Suzanne Ballet-Haight and Fred Breglia here today with us. And Sabrina is in Burlington. Hello, Sabrina.
Hi, folks. Thanks so much for your show today. I appreciate it. So I have a comment about compost. There's a terrific product out of Maine that I've been using for 24 years. I run my own small gardening service, and it's amazing. It's lobster and mussel shells and blueberries, and any of the products are just fantastic. I won't name it specifically, but it's from Maine, and
you can go ahead and name it.
Is it the Coastal Maine product?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's amazing.
I thought so.
Now, what is it about lobster shells that would be good for a soil?
They're full of all kinds of trace minerals and calciums and things that you just don't get otherwise. Any kind of shell will do that for you. And it's just, you know, it's beautifully broken down. It's a beautiful product. You know, I use it. I mix it in with the mulch oftentimes because it's absolutely gorgeous. And it makes a nice dark mix. I don't have to worry about feeding too much after that. I just highly recommend that for anybody out there who's looking to amend their soil. Mm-hmm. I do have a question, and I'm thinking of on my own rental property, my landlord has said I can pretty much do anything I want with my little postage stamp yard in the front. It's about 5x8. And what I'm thinking about doing is planting crimson clover.
Oh.
And just letting it go so it doesn't, you know, so it will bloom. It's got these beautiful red flowers on it, and it only gets about maybe, I'm guessing, 18 inches high or so, and, you know, no mow or anything like that. And I just think it'll be gorgeous, and I was wondering if you guys had any ideas about
crimson
that.
Crimson clover, Tommy James, right? Crimson and clover?
It certainly is.
Sure.
You know, in general, clovers are good for soil. They're they fix nitrogen out of their legume family. So they fix nitrogen out of the air, and they actually actually do a real lot to, it's been proven to enrich soils. So in that sense, you're doing really good. Also, it's going to be awesome for pollinators. Anytime you, you know, again, I'm a tree man here. So anytime you can kind of reduce your amount of turf, to me, that's kind of a good thing. Now, Bob's not here today, so I can get away with saying, anti-turf question stuff.
Right.
But in any case, I think that, you know, it's certainly better than mowing your lawn on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I also think it's better for the pollinators and wildlife.
That's a great idea. Thank you for the call. In fact, you know, this would be so good in my neighborhood. Imagine how irritated my neighbors would be I put just crimson clover all over the front yard. I am doing it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times people do let their yards kind of grow and they start to get wild and they get pollinators and they do have issues with neighbors.
Sure.
So,
yes.
So
well, they don't like me anyway. So it's
start. It's sort of a win-win then.
crimson clover, how tall does it grow? I've never heard of this thing except for the Tommy James song.
It's going to probably be somewhere
12, 15 inches.
Yeah,
yes.
It's really red.
Top out.
Nice looking stuff.
The flowers have a reddish tinge to it.
It looks like, you know how the clover has like more of that purple?
Yeah.
Well, this one's going to, it's just a variety with a little hotter.
I guess
you'd say a little hotter red flower.
And it'll attract the bees?
The foliage. It's certainly good for all. Yeah, pollinators, bees, it certainly love clover.
Oh my God, this will really irritate
honeys,
my neighbors. I love this.
Clover honey's really good.
You might have a few dandelions squeaking there.
Oh,
but that's good for the bees,
But
too,
that's also great pollinators. Exactly. Great for the pollinators.
We have that already. Let's take a break. Suzanne Ballet-Hayt is here. Fred Breglia is here. It's The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551. Great to have The Gardening Show back. We're a little delayed on account of the impeachment trial and everything else. We have Fred Breglia with us today. He's a regular. Suzanne Ballet-Hayt is new to the program. And if you have a question, it's 800-348-2551. Before we get to the emails and the calls again, Fred, the trail cam over at Landis Arboretum caught a very nice weasel. What is it?
Well, it's actually a fisher. It's okay. You're not too far off. Weasels, fishers, pine martens are all in that same sort of family.
But
we put up trail cams, of course, just to see who our nighttime visitors are and daytime visitors are, and sometimes we get some really neat visitors that show up in this.
That guy was posing.
He was absolutely posing. I got another one that I'll show you later on the next break. It's a deer that literally put their face. I think they're taking selfies on the cam now. It looks too much like a selfie not to be, so I'm thinking maybe they're starting to figure this out a little bit.
Now, you put the good ones up on the Landis website?
We generally do. Yeah, the website or the Facebook page is your sort of go-to for the day-to-day, what's going on, what's new at Landis. The website, I'd like to say, is our best marketing tool, landisarboretum.org, and that's got the year calendar events all on it. But the trail cam stuff and what's in bloom, you'll go to Facebook and you'll find out. We also have flowers in bloom this year, I wanted to say. First blooms of the year.
Wow, how about
that? Two woody plants, and I'll show you a photo of that on the break, too. But we have the vernal witch hazel and the Chinese witch hazel, and they actually, I think, are tied this year for first blooming, and they bloomed literally like, I think it was Monday after that last hot weather, and it's a little bit early this year. They are the first woody plant of the year to bloom, but this is even earlier for them. We have had a mild winter this year.
Which one did you find more beautiful?
You know, they're... in the past, I would say that the flower power of the Chinese is maybe a little bit more flower power than the vernal, but the vernal's a little bit more graceful flower. This year, you know, I honestly feel like it's almost a tie. They both feel like they really have that extra pop. I don't know if it's just been that mild winter. They really jazzed that, you know, spring's here. But they both really are. You can't go wrong. The vernal witch hazel is native to the United States, not New York. Chinese, obviously, native to China.
Right.
We're ready for some color.
We are. So we put those up on the Facebook, so take a look.
All right, fair enough. This email came in from Anne. Anne writes, I get full blazing sun on my back deck, so I'm thinking of growing things like hops and morning glories to climb on a trellis over the deck to create some shade. Do you think there might be better climbers than those. Any input as to plants or trellis strength is appreciated. And that's from Ann in Adams, Massachusetts.
Well, I guess you could grow it in a container or possibly in the ground next to the deck, but the honeysuckles are good in shade or sun. I love trumpet vine. That's a really fast grower, and it has really showy blooms in July. And
it'll crawl up the trestle? I think that's the idea, get the shade.
Yeah, it's a faster grower than a lot of the others.
All right.
And Dutchman's pipe, I mean, that'll grow in sun or shade as well, but it doesn't have a flower on it.
Okay.
Yeah, and hops, you had mentioned hops. Yeah, yeah.
That's fast.
Who doesn't like hops?
Right. Right. Well,
and they certainly cover vines, yeah. Cover trellises very fast, and actually it can be quite aggressive.
Now hops, well, I mean, if she gets the right hops, she could maybe make some money, right?
She could certainly make some beer.
Yeah, I mean, nice IPA.
Nice IPA is what I'm
thinking. Add a few flowers to the one.
That's tomorrow's show, alas. This one's from Rachel in Ballston. Due to a very long story that I won't get into, I was unable to plant some bulbs, daffodil and crocus, that I bought this past fall. What should I do with them? Can I plant them in the spring? And that's from Rachel.
Well, the ground is a little frozen right now, but you could put them in some pots and get them to bloom now, have a little cold period.
Will they be okay, though? I guess she got these. I don't know when she got them. She bought them in the fall, some bulbs, daffodil, crocus. Are they still going to be okay?
They might be okay as long as they were stored in a cool environment. If it was too warm, they might be a little mushy. So if they were in a cool environment, she could easily plant those again.
Give it a
pots.
Shot?
Give it a
it's
shot.
It's worth a shot. She might not get any blooms this year, but she might. It's worth a shot, I suppose.
Final email here, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This is from Matt in Sullivan County. Subject heading, tree bark. Hello, a pileated woodpecker has removed wide bands of bark from the bottom to top on several of my tall maple trees. Are they in danger of dying and or falling down? Hopefully not on my house. I've also noticed some trees have lost their tops. And that's from Matt in Sullivan County.
Yeah, so it sounds like he's got some decline. The woodpeckers are not going to just go and just start tearing away at wood. They're actually after grubs and they're feeding in there. So if he's at the point where you're seeing pileated woodpeckers, which are literally creating the biggest and creating huge galleries or tunnels of where they're pulling out that wood, that means he's got probably a lot of other problems, and the woodpecker's secondary. There are some things you can do if you can reach the area where they're feeding to deter them. Screen, old household screen, with either a staple or push pin over the areas, and that works really well for sapsucker damage as well. The little sapsuckers are a little small type of woodpecker that will feed also on grubs and various things, but that could deter them to sort of go elsewhere, but it's not going to solve the problem. And then he says trees with dead tops. That's telling me that there's some kind of an issue. Trees don't generally die from the top down.
Yeah.
They often have dead branches throughout the crown or from the bottom up, but a top-down decline tells me that the vascular system of that tree, veins and arteries, cambium, xylem, phloem, it's not pumping up the way that it would. And therefore, if you had an issue with circulation, which you're not saying you do.
It's pretty clear that I probably do.
But it would show up in your toes and your extremities. And, and if a tree has that, it would show up at the top. So, you know, this would be a case where they may want to get a consult by a certified arborist.
Okay.
And you can go to treesaregood.org or .com. And you can search that. It's a free resource put out by the International Society of Arboriculture. And by zip code, you could search certified arborists in your area. Hmm. And it would be, if you're having a bunch of trees with dying tops and woodpeckers coming in, that's probably time for maybe a consult.
Treesaregood.org. All right, fair enough. The number here is 800-348-2551. The Gardening Show, Suzanne Ballet-Haight and Fred Breglia to answer your questions. And Maria in Kerhonkson. Maria.
Hi, I'd like to know, how can I attract hummingbirds? What kind of flowers could I use? And again, what flowers do the hummingbirds do not like?
Okay.
They generally like flowers that are a little bit more opened or cup-shaped. Petunias are always a winner. We have hummingbirds coming through our greenhouse left and right before we think that they're there. All of a sudden, we have one flying through and loving the petunias mostly.
Bee balm is one, right?
Yep. So
they do.
So as perennials, it probably would be like bee balm, butterfly weed, butterfly bush. There's honeysuckle vine.
You getting any of this, Maria? Uh-oh.
Yeah, not sure.
Okay.
Oh, all right. If you want to, my personal favorite for a woody shrub is red vein Ichthyanthus. If I had to pick one, to bring in butterflies,
the hummingbird is what we're looking for.
Hummingbirds, butterflies, pollinators, bees, but definitely I've seen an incredible amount. It's very sweet.
What's the name of it?
It's Ichthyanthus.
Ichthyanthus.
Red vein Ichthyanthus. It's a plant that will grow hardy in our zone, and does well. I've had it at Atlantis since I've been there. It's been growing before I even got there. 24 years this May for me. So it does well. It's a ericaceous plant, and it's sort of like an azalea in terms of it's semi broadleaf evergreen. Sometimes they'll thin out a little bit through the winter time, but generally it keeps its leaves.
What'd you say, Maria?
Red vein Ichthyanthus.
Okay.
Two others of my favorites are Crocosmia lucifer. That's a fabulous perennial. And different types of Weigelia, usually the hotter colors, seem to attract the hummingbirds a little more.
All right, Maria, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551. If you have a question on this gardening edition of Vox Pop, we go over to Bruce in Plainfield, Massachusetts. Bruce.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, in a lot of planting directions and seedlings and so on, it will say to plant the seeds when the temperature is, soil temperature is, say, between 50 and 60 degrees or 60 and 70 degrees. And being a guy who likes to measure things, I actually started putting my thermometer in the soil. And what I found is that the temperature could vary wildly. If I, measure it one day, a cold gray morning, it's 45 degrees, and the next day, sunny afternoon, it's 65 degrees. I'm measuring like 3 or 4 inches down. I'm trying to figure out, when they talk about soil temperature, should I be taking sort of average? Should I be measuring in the morning before the sun starts to warm it up?
It's a good question.
I feel like an average temperature is usually the best way to go. Seeds will vary in how they'll germinate. So even though it says 55 to 65 degrees, it's okay if it goes a little lower to 50 or 70, up to 70. So they'll germinate at that average temperature. We use a heat mat in our greenhouse to start seeds, and that keeps the temperature pretty even. But the outside temperatures, I would go with an average temperature and make sure the soil is not frozen underneath.
All right, Bruce, good luck. Go ahead.
Right now, I can confidently say the soil temperature here is 32 degrees or lower. Sounds good. So I'll sort of measure it over a bunch of days and sort of take an average and figure that that's a good way to go. Can I slide in another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So I've had a lot of problems with some of the flower seeds are really tiny. And so I can do okay starting those inside, but some of them say to direct sow those, and then they say to keep the soil evenly moist, and I'm supposed to be covering them with like an eighth of an inch of soil. And so on a sunny day, that soil can dry out in 3 or 4 hours. So I'm thinking, how can I keep that soil evenly moist for, the maybe 2 weeks it may take for those seedlings to germinate when it dries out so quickly?
You could cover it with straw. You could use a thin layer of straw. You could also use, instead of soil to cover them, you could use an organic product, because soils are generally consisting of mineral particles, which are inorganic. Mm-hmm. And then there's organic particles, which actually absorb internally the water. The mineral particle, like sand, silt, and clay, is actually going to adsorb with a D. Not that this is trying to get too technical here with you, but the gist of it is that the sand, silt, and clay particle will not internally take the moisture in. It will only stick to the surface of it. So therefore, when you say things dry out very quickly, that's generally why. But if you get an organic particle, like even peat moss, those particles actually absorb internally that water, and it holds incredible amounts of water for a much longer period of time. So sort of, if you really were, trying to be extra picky in terms of making sure it didn't dry out, then I think you would use kind of like a peat moss, which would be an organic particle, or something else. Compost would work too, thin. And then you could very lightly cover it with straw. Not hay, because hay, we're going to get a ton of weed seeds, but straw does not does not do that.
Okay.
And, it'll break down and make a really rich, composty, black kind of soil over years, too.
Well, Bruce, thanks for the call. It's 800-348-2551, The Gardening Show, and Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
And hello to Susan and Fred.
Hello.
Hi.
As well. People who like ancient trees, ancient forests, large old trees, over in the little town of Sunderland, Massachusetts, right off of Route 116 in the center of the town. If you take a left going east on 116 at the one traffic light in town there, go down past the library on your left, and a few hundred yards down the street is a white sycamore tree that is over 8 feet in diameter, 4 feet off the ground. I measured it a few years ago.
Do you know what the name of that? Is it given a nickname by any chance?
There's a bronze plaque out in front of the tree along the street. You can't miss the tree.
Okay.
It looks like this gigantic hand just thrusting out of the earth.
Wow, that's incredible. I'll have to go visit that one.
Diameter. I didn't have a tape measure large enough to go around the tree. When I stopped there one time, I took a piece of rope and put it around the tree and then measured the rope with a smaller tape measure.
Wow, 8 foot diameter on that guy, huh? That's incredible. I'd love
it's
to see that.
Over 8 feet. It was some 26 feet in circumference.
Wow, that'd be an incredible one to share. So
it's been there since the first white settler ever came into the valley.
Cool. Very cool.
The Pioneer Valley.
If there's any chance you take a photo of that and send it to me, fred@landisarboretum.org, that would be great. Also,
I'll
I don't know.
To do that, yes.
Yep. And if you are a Facebook user, I don't know if you are. If you are, there's groups out there.
Wait,
one of them is called Big Tree Seekers. I actually founded the group.
Yeah.
And it's over almost 60,000 right. people, and the people really love to see this kind of thing. So if you're a member of Facebook, then join the group. Look for Big Tree Seekers. Find us. And you'll probably get, mm-hmm. 500 likes on that in a day.
Right.
I mean, you can't get enough. We can't get enough of these big trees.
All right, Jim.
Send us some photos.
Thanks
for the call.
Hey, were you in the New York Times or something? Something about the big tree
seekers?
Yeah. I thought I saw an article.
Yeah,
about
it was
you.
All. We had a heck of a year last year. We ended up. We knew about the billboard in New York City.
I remember that.
Tree City Blocks.
I thought I read something in a publication.
We were in the Union, the Gazette. We were on TV.
Maybe it was the Gazette.
It was the
New
Gazette
York Times, Schenectady Gazette. It's all the same.
We hit the cover of the Gazette and Union. I was going after the New York Times. It didn't pan out,
okay.
That story. But we made TV quite a few times, too.
I think I need to have you come to our place. We have this giant oak. We call it the Great Oak.
Oh, wow. We got a Great Oak in Atlantis. Awesome.
It's at least four people that have to go around this oak. And
awesome.
That's my favorite tree on the whole property.
Oh,
awesome.
You better go there.
I love great oaks.
By the way, before we
oaks
take...
Oaks are one of my favorites. I got a lot of favorites.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we
oaks.
Take the next call, Suzanne, where where is Ballet Flowers located?
We're about 3 miles from the harness track, or 3 miles from exit 13. And
you're on 9? 50?
Well,
what are you on?
Yeah, we're kind of hidden.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
We're on a back road. We're on Nelson Avenue Extension in the town of Malta.
Gotcha. All right, back to the phones we go, and who has been waiting the longest? Looks like Robert in Valencia. Robert, you're on.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Certainly.
Yes.
Oh, good. Name is Bob, and I live in Valencia. And Mr. Fred Breglia, I'm sure we do not remember each other.
Uh-oh.
But a few years ago, I brought you some ginkgo trees, a couple of ginkgo trees about 2 feet tall, because I propagate ginkgo trees.
Yes,
I
do remember that.
I've got
go ahead.
Sorry
about that.
I've got a magnificent mother ginkgo tree that my son and I planted about 45 years ago.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And my baby ginkgos spring up all over my property. Anyway, my question relates to a kind of indirect thing relative to these trees. I heat my house with wood, and I distribute the wood ashes all over my 2-acre property. Now, this has got some quantitative aspects to it, so my apologies. You might imagine maybe 3 5-gallon buckets of wood ashes a year, which I take care to spread all over these 2 acres. Am I going to get my soil into trouble eventually with the chemical aspect of this?
Well, it's a good question. A lot of people think, got wood ash, we want to use it, we want to compost it. So wood ash is good, but in the right quantity. And wood ash is also very powerful as a buffering agent with soil. It's a sweetener, has a very high powerful impact with alkalizing soil. So I like to say plants that like alkaline soils, sweet soils, you know, a little bit of wood ash on them, like lilacs, like a little alkaline, a little bit of wood ash, not bad. Too much wood ash, we start to create problems. So when in doubt, always soil test. If you're not sure and you're just putting it down for a period of time and you have trees like that in your property, when you start to adjust that pH, it's going to play a pretty big role with plant health rapidly. Now, if you're putting it down at such a rate that it's such a small amount and it kind of soil kind of works together with it, because, you know, a lot of times people do sweeten soil, but I really think you want to sort of get a soil test. So what I would recommend is instead of just getting like your random sample, which you want to make sure you take a really good random sample, and instead of just bringing it to the Cooperative Extension and having them give you the classic pH test, you actually take it a step further, have the Cornell crew send it out to Cornell University, and they'll do a fertility test, complete fertility test, and pH test. And honestly, Cornell Lab is probably one of the best, you know, certainly one of the best in the country for their soil diagnostics. So I think the fee was, the last time I did it, was like $26. But, you know, I like to say that's probably the best thing you're ever going to get for $26 is a complete fertility test from Cornell University. Don't quote me on the price. It could have went up to like 30 or something. But it's not very much. It's very cheap. And you could specify right in there, like, what kind of plants are in your yard. And they'll come back and they'll tell you. And then you'll know. And there will be no more guessing. And if it is starting to move towards that alkalinity, and they'll actually tell you recommendations, then maybe it's time to maybe compost some of that wood ash or something else with it. If you composted it and it broke down for many years, it would certainly change. Just like mulch, you put a mulch in a pile for a long enough period of time in terms of soil. So and the pH actually goes closer to, in a lot of cases, closer to neutral. But at first, it's not even close to that. So get a fertility test, and then you can make some recommendations from there. If you get that fertility test back and it has all this stuff that you don't understand, that same email, fred@landisarboretum.org, send it to me. I'd gladly break it down for you.
It's The Gardening Show here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we'll hit the home stretch in a moment. It's Vox Pop, The Gardening Show. Suzanne Ballet-Haight here on a debut appearance. Fred Breglia is here as well. He's a regular. 800-348-2551 is the number. Three or four emails here. This is from Barbara in Loudonville. Barbara writes, "My garden club created many
hypertufa.
Yep. Hypertufa planters. Now we need to plant them." First of all, before we get to your answer, what is a hypertufa?
Oh, it's amazing.
Really?
Container. Yep. You know, one of the things about hypertufa, you can make your own container out of natural products and like create any shape that you want. It's putting together perlite, peat moss, and Portland cement. And you can create a shape out of sand. You can use a rhubarb leaf. But we usually use two different pots that fit in together.
All right, so Barbara wants to know suggestions for planting them. I don't know exactly.
So hypertufa, usually what's in them is things that will take a little bit more dry conditions.
Yeah.
So succulents are fabulous.
Oh, really?
Different kinds of sedum, sempervirens, echeveria. If it's going to be outside for a long period of time, then maybe you want to plant some perennials in there that you can put the hypertufa pot in the garden as a unique kind of art piece in the garden. And one of the plants that I really love is German garlic or curly allium. And it just has a beautiful little lavender type ball flower, but the foliage kind of swirls around. So they call it curly allium because of that.
Right.
And a few Johnny jump ups. Maybe you want to put in some herbs. If it's right by your door, you can harvest some herbs. And
what's a Johnny jump up?
Johnny Jump Up, yeah. Little viola.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
Pansy family.
Johnny Jump Up. All right. This is from Teresa in Richmondville.
They're a cute little flower, actually.
They are cute.
Teresa writes, I have several black currant bushes, and last year I noticed some dead branches and reduced berries on my largest bush. I also noticed some white on leaves at the tips of some branches. Do you think it might have a fungal disease of some kind? And that's from Teresa.
You know, it does. It sounds like it's got certainly something going on where it's just starting to decline.
Yeah.
So, and then she's seeing white, and that could be powdery mildews. Not sure if she's looking at an insect or a disease.
Okay.
There are insects that also could be white, like there are aphids that are woolly aphids that they're not really that big of a problem. Powdery mildews generally won't make the whole plant start to decline. So I'm thinking, sounds like she probably has some other issues. And then these other things are kind of showing up more, especially if you got a decline. Otherwise, you would just see the white, but you would still see pretty much a healthy shrub. So that person certainly could email me some photos of the, because we don't want to just recommend treating something without knowing what it is.
Right.
So if they wanted to email me again, that fred@landisarboretum.org, happy to take a look at it.
And if there's some deadwood in there, like what I would do is cut out some of the deadwood, give it a little bit of a prune right about now, and then it'll start the season a little bit better. And then we use an organic spray on our anything that shows any signs of powdery mildew, and it also treats some other funguses. It's simple household products, baking soda, dish detergent, water. And 2 tablespoons of baking soda, 1 tablespoon of dish detergent, and 1 gallon of water. Put it in a little spritzer bottle and spritz your phlox, anything that might.
Even once you've already seen the white powder?
If you have seen it, you try to remove what you can. But if you can do it as a preventative measure, that's what we try to do on things that might be more prone to powdery mildew.
Okay. Yeah. I'm amazed the dish soap is okay.
Well, the dish soap makes it, the baking soda, stick to the leaves or the stems.
But it won't hurt the plant?
It won't hurt the plant.
Yeah, and when I generally use like an all, what do you call it, like an all natural dish detergent for it.
Yeah.
I don't think it would hurt if you did any dish detergent, but I always generally try to go with them, especially if it's for plants.
Yeah.
You know, sort of an all natural one. And if you can do it like you had mentioned, preventatively, you're going to have a lot more success.
Okay.
Especially when we go all natural. These fungicides, you want to just get them on before you see it. And if that's the case, it could help keep it looking good for a lot longer.
All right,
doesn't mean you won't get it, though. It
right.
It means it'll be less.
This email is the last one, and then we'll get back to the phones until we hit the end of the program. This one's from Matthew. I want to move a peony plant. Is it okay to do it this spring? And that's from Matt in Connecticut.
Ooh, perfect time to do it.
Really?
As long as this, I mean, it might be, the soil might be a little frozen right now. But as soon as you can get on the ground and move that peony, before it starts to grow, this is the ideal time to do that.
Okay.
And we sometimes take divisions. We'll split it in half and make new plants from it, too.
All right.
And if you are splitting it, the only point I would mention is that there's a little basal sort of root cup on it. And if you split the peony off and don't get a little bit of that basal root plate, then the division may not work. So you want to, when you do it, try to get a little, you'll see it at the bottom, kind of obvious. When you split them, try to get a little piece on every one of those divisions, and you'll increase the success of those transplants.
All right, let's jump back to the phones here. And Peggy in Saugerties. Peggy.
Hi. I have a very, very, very old lilac tree bush in my yard. It's over 80 years old. And I've cut back all the little sappers that were sucking all the life out of it because they were all over the branches, and it still isn't blooming like it should, and I just don't know what to do with it. It's not dead in any way. It's just very, very old.
Yep, that's actually quite common for old lilacs. So you have a couple of options. You generally want to try to, and I will, let me just ask this first, are you getting enough sun on the plant? Because if you're not
it gets plenty of sun.
All right, full sun, yeah, kind
of. Plenty of sun.
So what you're going to try to do is try to remove, eventually what you want to do is get rid of the big canes and have the smaller canes replace the big canes. So every, you know, generally if the plant's perfect in terms of, you know, hey, we take out like maybe 1/3 of all the oldest canes every couple of years. But when it gets to that point where all you have are these giant stalks and there's no other really smaller ones to cut or leave, then you're really talking about a rejuvenation pruning. And a rejuvenation pruning, it works really well with lilac. And it works with other plants too, but really well with lilac. You're going to wait till the buds begin to swell this spring, but they haven't actually opened yet. And you're going to literally cut those guys all off, all of them, 6 inches to the ground. And then that's going to create a massive, as long as you time it right, again, the buds are swelling, but they haven't opened. It's going to create a massive regrowth, and then you're not going to get no flowers this year, but you're not getting flowers anyways. And then you're going to selectively thin out all that mad regrowth, and you're going to have a brand new shrub, if you're patient, and a little bit of work in about 2 or 3 years. And it almost guarantee you will flower very heavily. So so that is the angle. I've been giving the email out all day here today. So Fred at Landis Arboretum, if you want some more specifics as we get closer.
And only 2 to 3 years. That's
really 1 year.
You really have to have some patience for a payoff.
She'll lose
like
it this
that.
Year. She'll have it next year.
Okay. And let's go to Carol in Gilderland. Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Very simple question. We've been in the same house for 47 years, and it wasn't until last year that the rabbits have attacked anything and everything I plant, specifically the hostas and the day lilies. What can I do?
Those rabbits, they're getting our hostas, too.
They're
very methodical. They start on one side and just keep going until the whole thing's gone.
Hot pepper spray is a good way to just deter them a little bit, but you got to also do that before they get a taste of it in the spring. And then every time it rains, you need to reapply. So it's a little bit of work, but the hot pepper spray, it works really great to keep away the rabbits. And you can make it yourself.
Like restore or what?
You can get it at a local garden center generally.
So basically like mace for rabbits.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, watch out.
Okay. The actual plant or the ground around it?
You spray the actual plant generally, and because then when they taste it, they're going to get a hot taste to it. But you could make your own hot pepper spray. You could get some hot peppers and boil them in water a little bit, and just to release some of the tannins in there, and add some dish detergent because that's what makes it stick to the plant, and a little bit of extra water. So.
If you really want to be nasty, they'll use the ghost peppers and the scorpion peppers.
The ghost peppers?
Ghost peppers are pretty hot. We use habaneros. So habaneros are pretty hot, too.
Pretty good, too. Yeah.
Well, Carol, thank you very much. The number is 800-348-2551. And now we go to Sunderland, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about forsythia, but I want to tell you about the sycamore tree first.
Awesome.
This is a big tree that someone called in about earlier. The sycamore tree is also known as a buttonball tree.
Yep.
And it's they say that it's been there since before Columbus. So it's the plaque on it says it was there at the writing of the Constitution. But it's the oldest sycamore tree east of the Mississippi.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Very cool.
And I learned about it in a biology class. Our teacher brought us up, and it's 7 grown-ups stretch arm to arm, stretched out, is how big around it is. It's just absolutely enormous.
Sounds incredible. Like everybody should take a field trip there.
It's on North Main Street, Sunderland.
Awesome. Right. If you have a photo and you feel like sending that in, send me a photo if you have it. And if you're on Facebook, consider joining Big Tree Seekers and sharing that guy. I know it's probably been shared before, but you can't share a big tree too many times.
Well, you said a mouthful there. Susan, thanks a lot for the call. And who's been waiting here? Oh, it looks like John. John in Poughkeepsie, your answer. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
I've been trying to train 3 honeysuckle to grow up a cedar trellis. It appears that they just hate the cedar trellis. Wherever they touch it, the stalks turn brown. Any ideas?
Don't all jump at once.
So every place it touches the trellis, you're losing the branches. You're losing those stems. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, they don't really lose them. They turn brown, and then where the stem turns out away from the trellis, it flowers again, and it goes back into the trellis. It turns brown.
Huh. Is your trellis made of depleted uranium by any chance?
You know, and the cedar has been outside for probably 12 to 15 years, so it's not new cedar.
Okay.
Not a lot of tannins in it.
Well, there's, you know, to me, there's kind of two reasons, you know, sort of you'd see that. There would be something in the wood itself, which I tend to think would actually not just turn brown right where the turn is. I would almost think you would see like that the shoot would not be doing as good and stuff. The other thing it could be is that if you're only noticing it where it turns, there's potentially more moisture in those areas. And honeysuckle does get a leaf blight when you have moisture conditions that favor it. So if it's only browning on the turn and then looks fine and the whole plant looks really good, it might just be a little bit of a leaf blight, but there might be something in that wood too. You know, you could certainly I guess you could test that theory as you get a couple of those shoots that are coming off. Don't put them, you know, keep them separate from the trellis, and if those are all looking really good and they're not getting any brown, then, you know, maybe it's more related to like one of those things we just talked about.
Do you have it tied up as well on the trellis?
I don't tie it to it. I just weave it behind it.
Yep. Okay.
Because if we tied it, that would be a good point.
All right. Well,
there's one particular spot where it comes out at the top, away from the trellis, and it blooms beautifully.
Is it getting full sun or shade, or part sun, part shade, or what are
it faces east, so it gets half a day's sun.
Yep. It might be a cultural thing, like a blight. It's not enough to kill it. A lot of the honeysuckles we see have little leaf blights, very common, but usually, you know, you don't see that if it's honeysuckles like more sun than not. So if you're getting shadier, and that's going to be more prone to that. Sounds like the, you know, a little bit of maybe that sort of like that's what might be going on with that plant. Maybe not enough sun, maybe not enough air movement, maybe a little bit of honeysuckle leaf blight.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Stacy in Tivoli. Stacy, you're on.
Oh, great. So I have a dogwood that took 10 years to bloom. Talk about patience. So now it's 18 feet high, and it's doing fine. But I want to know about these fertilizer sticks that someone told me to put in. And I don't know if it was coincidence or not, but that was the year that it finally bloomed. And I've been putting the fertilizer sticks in, but with hesitancy. So should I be doing this? The package says you should do it in late fall and early spring. And my master gardener friends tell me I shouldn't be doing it. So I thought I'd call and find out from the expert.
Well, let's go to Suzanne on this one.
Is this the first time that you fertilized with the sticks?
No.
What did you use before?
Yes, I used them like maybe 4 or 5 years ago when a neighbor said, why don't you try, you know, using these fertilizer sticks, because it had been 10 years of this thing not blooming. And it bloomed. That I did it in the fall, and it bloomed that spring or whatever, late spring, early summer. And now I'm sort of not sure if I should be doing it. I should say Tivoli is all clay soil. Mm. Literally, you can make a pot out of the soil in Tivoli. So that's why my neighbor had suggested it. But I don't know, now that it is blooming and it's 18 feet tall, should I still be doing it?
Yes.
And if I should, do I do it twice a year or not?
You should still fertilize. I think, you know, in the spring and the fall is the best time to fertilize. But when you want something to flower, you probably want a little bit more phosphorus. That promotes root growth and flowering. And if it's a fertilizer that it's NPK, nitrogen, potassium,
phosphorus,
potassium. And so the middle number is the number that you would want a little bit higher for flowering. So whatever it is that you're fertilizing that you want to flower, you want that middle number to be a little higher.
All right, that's it for the program today. We didn't get to my neighbor Becky, who wants me to plant the clover in the front yard to see if it'll work in her backyard. Becky, you may get your wish, so careful what you wish for. Thanks to Fred Breglia and Suzanne Ballet-Haight for joining us today. Support comes from assisted living at the Masry Residence at Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing seniors help with activities of daily living. To support an active lifestyle, 518-689-0453 for information and tours. Studio KTM Organic Hair Salon, featuring individual attention in a private environment with cutter and colorist Kristen Marquette using Naturalique organic products, studiokTM.com. the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting the post-Holocaust film 1945, March 8th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai. Discussion and dessert to follow, 518-584-8730. Once again, thanks to Fred and Suzanne for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Jim Harrison took the calls. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis, Jackie Orchard, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's beer on Food Friday. Oh, 2 o'clock. We'll see you then.